The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, we'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, The Price of Luxury. Million-dollar home sales skyrocket in the Triangle, but not everyone is celebrating as teardowns sprout. And that's the article on the front page. The headline on the front page, the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, A Quest for Fine Touches, Grand Scale. The number of million-dollar homes surges across the Triangle, altering neighborhoods and irking some as the landscape of the market goes more upscale. And this article is written by Ben Graham. The evidence of the Triangle's luxury housing reemergence can be seen on either side of Paul and Carol Stahl's home in Raleigh's Country Club Hills neighborhood. Over the past 2 years, builders cleared the lot to the north and erected a 6,300-square-foot home of white brick that now towers over the Stahl's single-story ranch built in 1958. On the other side, two more custom homes have been built and another lot cleared in preparation for construction. Paul Stahl, 68, moved into his house when he was 6 years old. It wasn't so long ago that deer and foxes would frequent the pine trees and scrubby brushes in the backyard next to the field where he played football as a kid. More recently, luxury home development has crept closer to his property line. In two words, it sucks, Paul Stahl says from his kitchen table on a recent afternoon. The new neighbors are nice, the couple says, but that doesn't make it easier adjusting. When they turn on the lights, it looks like the windows of an ocean liner, Carol Stahl says. Similar signs of the surge in the luxury housing market can be seen throughout Country Club Hills. On the back roads surrounding the golf course greens of Carolina Country Club, porta-potties and piles of red dirt sit on recently scraped lots in between new three-story brick homes. Some of the custom builders whose signs line the neighborhood streets are almost as new as their product, and the action isn't limited to teardowns inside the Beltline. In North Raleigh, the upscale Avalair community, one of the few new luxury subdivisions since the recession, has buyers for nearly half of its homes. The builders are riding a trend that is taking place across the Triangle. Business is on the upswing in the upper echelon of the housing market. In 2017, the Triangle saw 256 recorded home sales of more than $1 million, according to the luxury housing report of Birch Appraisals' Stacy Anfinson. That's a 37% increase over 2016, 187, and more than triple the number of $1 million homes sold in 2010. Some home sales are excluded from the data because luxury home sellers don't always list their properties on the Triangle multiple listing services, meaning there are more expensive homes being sold that don't show up in the data. The surge in luxury homes has impacts beyond the custom building industry, and not everyone is feeling the effects in the same ways. That includes luxury homeowners themselves, some of whom haven't necessarily seen the value rebound for homes built before the recession. The uptick also comes at a time that city officials are grappling with affordable housing shortages as competition for land and rising construction costs are driving new home prices skyward in all tiers of the market, factors that conflate to push homeowners in lower price points farther out into the suburbs. As teardowns continue to get replaced by million-dollar homes from North Hills to McGregor Downs, Country Club, and new communities such as Avalair and Bella Vista in North Raleigh put up 7,000-square-foot estates, longtime observers of residential real estate in the Triangle say one thing is certain. The surge shows just how high the Triangle's reputation has risen. It's moving on up in the world, Anfinson says. The natives are stunned when they see all the wealth that's come here. Surviving and thriving. Few people in the Triangle can build a home like Rex Bost. In a Rex Bost house, you might find a toilet seat that rises automatically when you open the bathroom door. In one house he recently built in Avalair, the two-story closet just off the master bedroom is so spacious, it has an elevator for racks of clothing. One of Bost's few peers in the Triangle is John Rufty of Rufty Homes. Rufty once sent an employee to India to meet the manufacturer of a type of hand-cut stone a client wanted. Someone gives us a wish and we follow it to the nth degree, Rufty says. Combined, their client list includes a who's who of executives, entrepreneurs, surgeons, and a few professional athletes. Bost and Rufty have been in the business for decades and were among the handful of custom builders able to weather the last downturn. In the years leading up to the recession, they remember a red-hot real estate landscape in which prices escalated and more builders entered the high-end market. A lot of builders that were building at a lower price point saw the opportunity to build bigger and bigger houses, Bost says. Veterans such as Bost and Rufty survived the downturn by adapting. Rufty diversified his operations, branching into commercial building and avoiding layoffs. Others, like Trip Lloyd of Lloyd Builders, another veteran of luxury home building in the Triangle, found new partners once bank lending dried up. But some weren't so fortunate. There were a lot of people who went out of business or changed professions, Lloyd says. People who were close to retirement age called it quits. Those who stuck it out are witnessing the reemergence of the luxury market. Last year saw the most expensive home sale ever recorded in the history of the Triangle MLS, a $6.35 million estate in Chatham County's Hills of Rosemont, which sold to new Cree CEO Greg Lowe and his wife Diana. The previous record sale on the Triangle MLS was a $5 million home on Oberlin Road in Raleigh that closed in February 2008, just as the economy was tipping into the downturn. Change in financing environment. Before the Great Recession, one of the drivers behind the luxury market was easy money for builders and buyers. People looking to have a builder design and construct a custom home could get a loan to fund the entire endeavor without having a lender verify their income or assets, says Tina Conaderis, Raleigh division manager at Primary Residential Mortgage. She saw lenders require as little as 5% down. For builders, it was easier to obtain lines of credit to buy lots and build homes without having a buyer beforehand, a speculative practice known as building spec homes. Those are the two ways in which high-end luxury homes typically get built, either by a builder doing a bit of speculating or by a buyer getting a loan to buy a lot and fund the design and construction of a new home. Both changed dramatically in the wake of the downturn. Money for the builders to construct new homes without a buyer dried up. All these banks pulled their spec lines of credit, says John Gates of Union Mortgage Group. For home buyers, the rules got strict. Once banks did begin lending again, some required as much as 30% equity, Boss says. Since then, the lending landscape has lightened up considerably. Boss says lenders who may have required 30% equity have dropped that to 20%. Conaderis has seen the required equity to as low as 10% in some cases. The lending market for builders has reemerged as well. Gates says his business for loans to prospective homebuyers has decreased over the past 2 years, while the lending business to builders has increased. Conaderis views all of this as the market finding a comfortable middle. She has seen new buyers put large amounts of equity down, a sign she takes as people still being cautious. These days, the pendulum has started to fall more toward the middle, more toward common sense, Conaderis says. Bost and other builders brush off concerns about overheating, saying the lending environment isn't as loose as it once was and that there is pent-up demand for new luxury homes. I feel like things are in a good place, Bost says. Every new company putting down roots in the Triangle brings new executives in search of housing, and the overall tax and business climate has only bolstered confidence. I think most are looking at some of the tax changes that were made and feeling better about the economy and where we're going, says Mark McDonald, one of the real estate investors behind Avalair. Despite recent stock market volatility, potential buyers see that interest rates are going up, and many are deciding to buy now. The Triangle also lags behind some of its comparable metros around the Southeast when it comes to higher-end housing. That fact alone is comforting to people in the real estate industry who say there is still much room for growth here. In the Triangle, 2.3% of home sales last year were above $750,000, according to Metro Study. That proportion represents a substantial climb for the Raleigh-Durham area from as recently as 2013, when it was 1.2%. But it's still far behind places such as Nashville, Tennessee, which saw 3.5% of its housing sales surpass $750,000 in 2017. In Charlotte, 2.8% of homes sold above that threshold. Places such as Atlanta and Austin, Texas, fall somewhere in between. Trouble for older high-end homes. Still, not everyone has been able to ride the wave of luxury home sales, including some luxury homeowners themselves. Some people who bought before the recession are now finding themselves with a house that is more than a decade old and no longer in sync with the tastes of today's custom buyers. That makes it difficult to sell. You walk into these resales and they feel so old and dated because the new stuff looks so different, real estate agent Linda Kraft says. Even color preferences have changed. According to Kraft, shades of mocha or dark brown were in before the recession, but no longer. Now it's all kinds of gray. There are new styles of granite and quartz, new bathroom finishings. All of these factors can make it difficult to sell a used luxury home, which can be problematic for people who paid top dollar pre-2008 and have been waiting for the market to turn around before selling. There are still a lot of people who bought houses in 2006 and 2007 where what they paid at that time, their property is not worth that amount today, says Joe Hodge, owner of Hodge & Cottrell, Sotheby's International Realty in Raleigh. He knows because he's one of them. I bought it at the peak, Hodge says, of his house, which is inside the Beltline. Wake County records show the purchase price is $1.6 million. I don't think I could sell it for what I paid for it, he says. Today, the tax value of the home is $1.472 million. Widening impact. More building at the higher end of the market can also impact other tiers of the housing landscape. Production builders, those who specialize in erecting large subdivisions with many homes, say a shortage of well-located land, coupled with the rising cost of labor, materials, and dirt, are putting a squeeze on their ability to build lower-priced homes, and that is the tier of the market with the most pent-up demand. But the high cost of land and labor can push buyers into pursuing homes at a higher price point. I think, unfortunately, it's sort of all connected, says Brant Chesson, president of Homes by Dickerson. A lot of buyers are forced into the upper price ranges simply because they want a certain home, and that's what the price point is. Lloyd of Lloyd Builders says he has seen the price of similar homes with the same finishes skyrocket by $200,000 in just the last 2 years. For buyers at lower price points, the only answer to rising costs and the growth of the luxury market is to search farther away from urban centers. Certainly, that growth has had an influence on people having to go farther out, Chesson says. In other parts of the triangle, the pressures of higher-end housing have led to a robust tear-down market, which is good news for buyers in search of new homes, but not necessarily for people witnessing their neighborhoods change. Back in Country Club Hills, the stalls have watched over the decades as the neighborhood has become a haven of upscale homes built to the edge of their lots, and more recently as the changes crept up to their own property line. The stalls have received a steady series of phone calls and knocks on the door from real estate agents asking them whether they would consider selling their 2,376-square-foot home, originally designed by noted architect Milton Small. The couple still has many of the original appliances, including a stovetop that folds out of the wall. Offers for the home have all been under the $824,000 tax value of the 0.9-acre lot, as assessed by the county. At one point, an agent asked them to name a price. Paul said $1.2 million, to which the agent chortled, saying that was unrealistic. At their age, the stalls have no real plans to move. They can let their hedges grow a bit taller to block some of the construction and street noise and enjoy the abundant bird life that visits their backyard feeders. They are realistic about the inevitability of change, but that doesn't make it easy. It's just a shame, Paul Stahl says, to lose the flavor of the neighborhood. And now we'll turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Could Construction Sector Be First Casualty of Tariff War? Any way you look at it, this can't be good. Analyzing two sets of statistics that came across my desk in the past few days has solidified my belief that the construction industry may be slowing down faster than originally thought. Dodge Data and Analytics, a firm specializing in construction data, announced its latest residential and non-residential construction data for three local counties, Wake, Johnston, and Franklin, and we are seeing a big dip in construction spending. Non-residential construction data from February, pre-tariff saber-rattling, showed the dollar volume of projects was down 66%, from $205 million to $69 million from the same time last year. For residential, the dollar volume was up about 5% from $208.4 million to $219 million. While for the first 2 months, the dollar volume of residential sector was still up some 31%, the same metric was up 54% in January. And by all accounts, when March numbers come out a little later in April, it now is very likely that the year-to-date number will be even lower. For non-residential construction, construction spending dropped from $96 million in January to $69 million in February. Concerns regarding rising materials prices are also becoming more intense, particularly in light of the recent enactment of tariffs on steel and aluminum and growing fears of a trade war and material shortages, says Anirban Basu, the chief economist for the Associated Builders and Contractors, ABC, after he reviewed the national construction data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Basu, however, also adds that for 2018, construction spending will still finish strong despite the growing headwinds. I disagree with that last statement because of how things went down in 2009, 2010, and 2011. The moment lending institutions believe that headwinds are getting stronger, the spigot is going to close. This time around, financiers will not be the ones holding a ginormous amount of real estate and unfinished construction projects on their balance sheets. And let's not forget about the stock market. If Wall Street puts together a series of trading days such as the one in April on April 2, public companies may rein back spending during the second quarter. That would also mean less stock-based M&As because no one wants to do a deal when their share prices have fallen precipitously. Also, let's not forget a primary reason for the surge in share prices, stock buybacks. S&P 500 firms have bought back almost $4 trillion of their own shares since 2010. Repurchases and takeovers have made companies themselves the biggest source of demand for U.S. stocks during that time. Maybe with prices down, these companies would buy even more of its own shares with the money that would have gone paying corporate tax. The gradual drop in construction spending is going to be an issue for general contractors who may already be struggling to find skilled labor, such as estimators and project managers. And if construction shows signs of further slowdown in the next couple of months, a fair question then would be, has the economy peaked? And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Iconic Atlantic Beach restaurant can now be yours. Come over the bridge from Morehead City into Atlantic Beach with its spectacular view of the water and beach town ahead, and the Channel Marker restaurant has owned a prominent spot at the water's edge in Atlantic Beach since 1981. But as summer approaches, the restaurant is closed and for sale. An ownership group that includes William Downey of Durham has listed the 9,690-square-foot restaurant and 0.9-acre property for $2.5 million. Because it's got the dramatic location and it definitely has a brand name, everybody knows what the Channel Marker is, says commercial real estate veteran Marcus Jackson of Trademark Properties, who has listed the property. Jackson says the partnership that owns the restaurant isn't primarily in the food business and decided it was time to turn the location over to someone more focused on that industry now that the Crystal Coast has grown and more restaurants have arrived. You've got a lot of competition that has come in, especially on the Morehead City side, Jackson says. They'd rather sell it and have a new beginning, get a new life. One of the challenges for a traditional restaurant is a crowd that drinks tea and eats seafood isn't as profitable as, say, a crowd that prefers mixed drinks in addition to dinner. Jackson says he can see the space being reimagined to take advantage of the sweeping views and catering to a younger crowd. New start coming in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill has lost its share of iconic restaurants through the years, such as the Porthole and the Rathskeller, and another tumbled into history March 31. Spanky's, at the corner of Franklin and Columbia Streets, opened in 1977 when Mickey Yule was inspired by restaurants in the Georgetown district of Washington, D.C. Spanky's, owned by the Chapel Hill restaurant group that included Yule, thrived for decades, but Greg Overbeck, another CHRG partner, says a number of factors worked against it. When things really changed was when the drinking age changed to 21, he says. That cut back on our late-night business. Also damaging was a perceived lack of parking and rise of other options. We have about 100 restaurants in Chapel Hill. That's a lot of competitors, Overbeck says. The group plans a quick pivot on the space. Overbeck says CHRG will open a new restaurant in the location with a more affordable menu later this month. She wants women to feel beautiful one store at a time. Fabrique founder Dana Spinola recalls how she grew up without the money to shop in women's stores. That would be a crazy dream, she says. But when Spinola was climbing the ranks at Deloitte in her early 20s, she pivoted to start a clothing store. After 14 banks told her no, one banker asked, "Why are you so unique?" When she hesitated, he said, "Go home and come back and tell me why." Her answer recalled a visit to Versace. "I remember walking into Versace and they offered me a glass of champagne," she says. "I couldn't spend a penny, but they treated me with respect. I felt so dignified. When I came back and talked to the banker, I said, I'm going to have first-class customer service for a $70 dress." Now, Fabrique has more than 40 franchises. She planned to visit Raleigh's Cameron Village location April 4 and speak at NC State University. "I believe in following your passion and finding your purpose," she says. "My purpose is making women feel beautiful, inside and out." Raleigh firm celebrates Pi Day by helping students. Stewart, a Raleigh-based engineering and planning firm, is looking to improve the pipeline of engineers. Employees raised a total of $3,141 on March 14 during Pi Day celebrations. That money will help send 12 students to engineering summer camps across North Carolina. The funds raised were matched by the firm and will help in sending three campers to NC State University's College of Engineering summer programs, four to UNC Charlotte's Camps on Campus program, and five to NC A&T State University's Aggie Enrichment Camps. Raleigh firm helps veterans enter cybersecurity battle. After defending the U.S. overseas, disabled veterans are getting trained to defend computer systems in North Carolina through a cybersecurity apprenticeship program jump-started by a company in the Triangle. Raleigh IT firm ISG offers five apprenticeship slots for veterans who receive training from the company to prep them to obtain a security certificate and find a job when the two-year program is over. Cybersecurity is not the next front, it is the front, apprentice Vicky Stewart says in a YouTube video about the program. Stewart is a retired U.S. Army sergeant who was injured 22 years ago in the Khobar Towers bombing in Saudi Arabia. "I have so appreciated when people say, 'Thank you for your service,' but when I was selected for this program, it said to me, 'Thank you for your service,' on a whole different level," she says. The benefits run both ways. Cybersecurity firms are having a tough time finding qualified workers, a shortage the program will help address. ISG helps participants with job placement near the end of their apprenticeship. The program is a partnership between the North Carolina Department of Information Technology, ISG, Wake Technical Community College, and other educational institutions. The two-year, $500,000 pilot program is in its second year. The program was personal for Tony Marshall, ISG's president and CEO. His father was a career soldier. "I've always realized that the transition out of the military is not as straightforward as people think it is," Marshall says. And finally, let's head to Syracuse. Raleigh-Durham International Airport covets direct flights to some lovely spots, think San Diego and Portland, Oregon, so biz perked up when learning Frontier Airlines was announcing three seasonal destinations from the airport. Well, turns out the flights are to Syracuse, New York, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Portland, Maine. Syracuse? Not exactly a resort town, but at least it's in the Atlantic Coast Conference. And while Portland, Maine might not be as exotic as its namesake in Oregon, any time spent in Maine is time well spent. But we still want San Diego. And now we turn to the On Technology and Innovation page written by Lauren Onasorge. IBM's Agile space at RTP looks to spark collaboration. On the third floor of IBM's Research Triangle Park Executive Briefing Center, over a walkway, you'll find the Forest. At least that's the vibe that Bruce Sargent, the RTP-based director of North America real estate operations for IBM, hopes you'll get from the newest Agile workspace, complete with 500 workstations, a handful of giant beanbag chairs, and a vertical moss wall. It's an outdoor North Carolina theme, Sargent explains. For IBM, it's a new way to spark collaboration. Fran O'Sullivan, IBM's RTP site lead, who recently announced retirement plans, says it's working, calling it the initiative she's most proud of during her tenure. The new space, which welcomed its first employees in February, brings IBM's total agile space to RTP to more than 250,000 square feet. For this installment, Sargent took ideas from other campuses, but also added completely new elements, such as soundproofed privacy compartments and a break room with two double refrigerators. It's the third agile implementation for Sargent, who oversaw the floor's transformation from static white-walled cubicles to steel framing to what it is today. Unlike IBM's other RTP Agile workspace, the marketing and communications professionals working here have a dedicated seat environment. In the first Agile space, workers armed with laptops have no official desk. They can move around and plug their laptop into any station. Here, since marketing and communications professionals have more of a set schedule than workers in some other departments, they're allowed to personalize a desk of their own. And, judging by the empty workspaces, more people could work out of the space in the coming months. There's definitely room to grow, Sargent says. Each section, called a meadow, is named after a bird to carry the forest vibe forward from mallard to kingfisher. Desks are cluttered together as opposed to being separated by walls. For privacy, workers can head into one of the furnished nooks or take it a step further and hide away in one of the quiet booths, framed by special sound absorption material. And when workers want to meet with colleagues from around the globe, a video conference room can make it seem like they're across the room instead of thousands of miles away, Sargent says. The space is just beginning for the RTP campus. Already, Sargent is evaluating what work groups will go agile next. PRA, Red Hat, among top insider sales so far this year. From BioDelivery Sciences International to Red Hat, insiders at Triangle Companies raked in millions in the first 3 months of 2018 by selling shares, SEC filings show. All of the top five sales involved insiders exercising derivatives or in-the-money securities. In all but one, Mark Sergo, the retired CEO of Raleigh-based pharma BDSI, were contract research organization executives. At the top of the list is David Dockhorn, a 20-year veteran of PRA Health Sciences, a CRO. On January 2, he exercised his derivatives to sell nearly $5.8 million in shares. The top tech seller for the quarter was Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst. He sold more than $1 million in shares in January, classified in an SEC filing as withholding securities for payment. In all, 18 executives sold batches of shares in Triangle Companies worth more than $100,000 in the quarter. Of those, 11 involved executives or directors exercising derivatives, and 11 of the 18 executives are in the life sciences industry. The sell-offs could be just the beginning, as first quarter sales pale many of the payouts insiders saw in 2017. Last year, the blockbuster sales were associated with mergers and acquisitions. The biggest insider sales were linked in the second half of the year, such as a December 4 one-day stock sale by Equivia director John Connaughton, valued at more than $118 million. Raleigh tech firm acquired, new parent plots hires. Texas online self-storage marketplace Sparefoot is acquiring Raleigh's SiteLink in a deal that, according to the CEOs, will bolster their attack on the $38 billion self-storage industry. Ross Lamp, CEO of SiteLink, says he and his firm have 85 employees, of whom 75 work on Atlantic Avenue, and a software presence in 10,000 stores across the nation. "We've just quietly built up a business-to-business software offering," he says. The software his team is engineering helps self-storage companies such as Ample Storage manage their businesses. It runs the individual stores where tenants come in and out. It provides a web platform for them to make payments with modules so that companies with multiple sites can manage them through the same software. Co-Founders Capital targets funding gap with 75 investors, including some big entrepreneurial names in the Triangle, are funneling cash into a new fund that, if serial entrepreneur David Gardner has his way, will be one of the largest venture funds in the Southeast. Fund 2 for his Cary-based Co-Founders Capital has $20.5 million in its coffers right now, according to a securities filing April 3. The filing caps the round at $50 million. The round includes infusions from the likes of Channel Advisor co-founder Scott Wingo, former Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina CEO Bob Gretchen, and real estate entrepreneur Anthony Dilwig. Fund 2, like the co-founders Fund 1 he raised in 2015, could fuel seed-stage technology startups up to $500,000 apiece, but unlike Gardner's first raise, it could also fuel follow-on investments. And now we turn to the On Life Sciences page, written by Jennifer Henderson. UK-based MedPharm adds staff in Durham. UK-based pharmaceutical development and manufacturing company MedPharm is continuing to grow its Durham location with new investments in headcount and equipment. The company has also recently secured a growth equity investment by Ampersand Capital Partners. "We've had massive growth," says John Len, MedPharm's senior vice president of U.S. operations. The company opened its Durham operations in May 2016, starting with 4 employees, and has grown to 21 employees now. It expects to be at 24 employees in Durham within the next couple of months. Overall, MedPharm is approaching 130 employees, with more than 100 employees based in the U.K. With the bulk of clients based in the U.S., having a U.S. presence was a key part of the growth, Len says. Prior to the investment by Ampersand, for which financial terms were not disclosed, MedPharm recently invested $750,000 in new equipment to further automate testing capabilities in Durham. New equipment in Durham includes a Hamilton Vantage robot for sample handling. The robot is expected to reduce testing variation and increase throughput. Focused on topical and transdermal areas of work, MedPharm is looking to, quote, accelerate growth in some areas outside of skin, unquote, such as the eyes and lungs, according to Len. With the business grown through revenue for the past 2 decades, that limits the growth to some extent, notes Len. The new investment by Ampersand really opens up new opportunities to accelerate our growth and diversify to a bigger scale. Following the investment by Ampersand, leadership and day-to-day operations will remain unchanged, he says. California firm forms partnership with BCBSNC. Landmark Health of Huntington Beach, California, is planning its North Carolina entrance through a new partnership with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, according to Jessica Diaz, Senior Director of Brand and Marketing at Landmark. "We're a risk-based provider group that cares for chronic, complex populations," she says. "We partner with health plans and identify subsets of their population that really need more care." The new partnership will see Landmark set up shop in the Triangle and Triad, as well as in Charlotte and Fayetteville, she says. Landmark will begin serving patients in North Carolina in June. It currently serves patients in California, New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Washington State. The expansion in North Carolina will involve a lot of hiring, according to Diaz, for physicians, nurses, and social workers, among other positions. Company-wide, Landmark employs about 600. "We've been actively hiring, and that continues," she says. In each of the state's regions, Landmark will build up providers in the community that can then call on members in their homes. While financial terms of the new partnership are not being disclosed, Diaz says Landmark shares the risk with its health plan partners. She says that BCBSNC plan members will have no cost for the service. "The goal is to keep the population Landmark serves healthy and out of the hospital with readmissions reduced. Cost savings are then shared by the health plan with Landmark." The new partnership will see Landmark reach 6,500 patients in North Carolina, according to Diaz. "Our members would rather be at home instead of in the emergency room," Dr. Patrick Conway, president and CEO of BCBSNC, said in an email. "Through this partnership, we are now able to offer an added level of care to help members manage their conditions at home and stay ahead of a crisis that would otherwise put them in the hospital." Raleigh firm makes latest pharma buy. On the heels of its local acquisition of Viamet Pharmaceuticals, investment firm NovaQuest Capital Management of Raleigh has scooped up a 20-year-old company out of Wilmington, Massachusetts, called Cutis Pharma. Founded in 1998, Cutis Pharma had no institutional investors prior to the end of 2014, according to Ampersand Capital Partners, which made a growth equity investment in the company in a $20 million financing at that point. Ampersand announced its exit from Cutis Pharma recently through the acquisition by NovaQuest, which spun out from Quintiles in 2010. Financial terms of the deal are not being disclosed. Cutis Pharma commercializes kits to help pharmacists compound prescriptions easily and in compliance, according to the company. In an earlier interview, NovaQuest partner Patrick Jordan said the company will continue to look for ways to address development and commercialization challenges that the biopharmaceutical industry faces through funding or operational involvement. Another BioCryst investor opposes Idera merger. Great Point Partners isn't the only significant BioCryst shareholder that plans to vote against the Durham Company's planned merger with Idera Pharmaceuticals of Exton, Pennsylvania. RA Capital Management, which owns 7.1% of BioCryst common stock, states in a letter to BioCryst board that it intends to vote against the merger at a shareholder meeting May 9. RA Capital agrees with arguments previously presented by Great Point, including an undervalued BioCryst asset, lack of consideration of other alternatives, and a disproportionate benefit to one shareholder. If the ongoing Phase 3 trial of BioCryst drug candidate BCX7353 is successful, we believe it can generate enormous value for the shareholders when data are reported in the first half of 2019, states RA Capital in its letter. It has the potential to be the most convenient treatment option in the vast and fast-growing hereditary angioedema market. Last month, BioCryst said it has initiated that trial of BCX7353, putting the company closer to U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval for the drug in a market slated to top $2 billion. A merger with Idera will not increase the probability of success of the BCX7353 Phase 3 trial, nor will it create long-term value for BioCryst shareholders, states RA Capital in its letter. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "If you came here and your career plans require a law license, then we're committed to getting you one." J. Rich Leonard, Campbell University Law School Dean, after CU was among the nation's top schools for bar exam passage, the American Bar Association says, Campbell was number 15 with a rate within 2 years of graduation of 98% for its 2015 graduating class. Now we turn to On Real Estate, written by Ben Graham. LabCorp cuts deal for significant space in RTP. Burlington-based LabCorp is moving into more than 200,000 square feet of office and lab space at the former GlaxoSmithKline space in Research Triangle Park. The company, which runs a large network of clinical laboratories, has inked a 15-year lease for space at Parma RTP, according to sources familiar with the deal. A LabCorp spokesman wouldn't confirm the lease and declined to comment on whether it represents an expansion or relocation for the company. LabCorp already has a substantial presence in the Triangle, including a major laboratory on T.W. Alexander Drive, called the Center for Molecular Biology and Pathology, and has a recent track record of enlarging its footprint here. Last year, the company opened a new lab at Perimeter Park under its Covance drug development business arm. At that time, the company said it had 1,500 employees in the Triangle. LabCorp acquired Covance in 2015 in what has become a string of acquisitions for the company as it seeks to expand its operations. Also last year, LabCorp completed a $1.2 billion takeover of Chiltern International, which specializes in the contract research sector and was brought under LabCorp's Covance business. LabCorp recorded more than $10 billion in revenue in 2017. In a February earnings call, LabCorp CEO David King said one of the company's primary focuses for the coming year will be to integrate its acquisitions. The acquisition of Chiltern, in particular, is expected to be the largest driver of growth in 2018. The lease at Parma RTP will take up a sizable chunk of space at the former GlaxoSmithKline campus, which the company sold to Parmer RTP in May 2017. Kane buying more land near New Union Station. Kane Realty Corporation is looking to buy a property in downtown Raleigh that is more than twice the size of nearby the Dillon development, also a Kane project. Kane Realty CEO John Kane confirms that his company has nearly 7 acres under contract just south of the New Union Station and has plans for a dense, mixed-use development on the site. The company hasn't submitted a rezone request yet with the city, but plans to soon, Kane says. The property would likely include a mix of office and residential with the potential for ground floor retail. The property belongs to Clancy and Thays Construction and is on Cabarrus Street, just 2 blocks south of the Dillon, next to the old Amtrak station. Kane Realty is still putting the final touches on the Dillon, an 18-story tower and residential development, and has already begun opening its first units to residents. The total size of the Dillon site is 2.5 acres. The Clancy and Thays property ticks in at 6.8 acres. Kane says the site is a unique opportunity in an area where developable land is scarce. It's hard to find tracts downtown that are of a decent size, he says. We've looked quite a bit. The Clancy and Thays office building dates to 1971, says Tim Clancy, president of Clancy and Thays Construction, and opened just 5 months before he began working there. The site, which includes several single-story buildings, has an assessed tax value of $7.7 million, according to county records. The company doesn't have specific plans yet on where it would relocate. Investor sees value in aging triangle apartments. Michael Levy can't stop buying old apartment complexes in the triangle. On March 27, his firm, Gem Holdings, closed on two in North Raleigh, both dating to the 1970s, Casa del Sol and Casa de Luna. The property sold for a combined $30.75 million, or just under $79,000 per unit. That's substantially less than many of the recent higher dollar multifamily sales in the triangle, and Levy views the aging complexes as good deals. His company has purchased 8 apartment communities in the triangle, including 6 since last summer. All of them are old. The market is strong. We believe in it, Levy says. We like buying older assets where there's opportunity to add value. The recent sales of aging multifamily complexes, including the $14.5 million sale of the 1970s era Lindwood Park Apartments in North Hills in late March to a separate New York investor, shows there is sustained interest outside of just the higher-end multifamily market, which continues to track ahead of last year. Through the first quarter of 2018, there were 7 apartment complex sales of more than $40 million. In 2017, there were 16 sales of multifamily developments over that threshold for the entire year, according to Triangle Business Journal data. Levy says his firm views the acquisitions as long-term investments. Substantial renovations are planned for Casa del Sol and Casa de Luna. Gem Holdings is repeating this business model elsewhere around the state. In the last 4 years, the company has bought 7,000 units, with much of that growth concentrated in North Carolina, he says. The multifamily deals come in the midst of new apartment openings in the triangle. Vacancy rates have increased slightly, but analysts say occupancy remains strong. New North Hills Tower to add more senior living. A new tower is in the works for the North Hills skyline. The Cardinal at North Hills is planning a 15-story building with penthouse residences for retirement-age people looking for urban amenities, according to the developer. The high-rise will have approximately 160 new residences, including some units larger than 2,000 square feet, featuring balconies overlooking Midtown Raleigh. Cardinal and North Hills officials say the plans are in reaction to growing demand for rentals in continuing care retirement communities. The development will be part of the larger Cardinal at North Hills retirement community, which opened last year. Another addition, a health care services building, opened last summer, providing assisted living services and memory care. The larger units and umbrella of services provided at the campus allow residents to seek the level of care or independence that matches their needs, Cardinal at North Hills officials stated. And finally, 2 years later, Durham Hotel sale brings in $2.7 million. A hotel owner has flipped the Comfort Inn on Hillendale Road in Durham, selling it for $2.7 million more than the sale price was 2 years ago. Rux Maya Incorporated, a motel company with an address in Weddington, sold the two-acre property and 65,000-square-foot building for $7.9 million. The firm previously bought it in 2016 for $5.2 million. Members of the company include Balvant Jariwala of Weddington and Chetan Patel of Charlotte. The buyer, Durham Hospitality Incorporated, is a company managed by Keaton Desai, Senior Director of Development at MedFusion Incorporated. The hotel dates to 1987 and was previously sold in 2010 for $5.05 million, according to Durham County Records. And now we move over to On Retail and Restaurants, written by Dathan Kazuk. Alamo Draft House gears up for grand opening. The Texas-based Alamo Draft House Cinema is set to debut April 16 in Raleigh, serving food, libations, and free VHS and DVD rentals as a longtime Raleigh shopping area looks to get revitalized. The venue will feature 48 beers on draft, with a majority brewed in North Carolina. Also coming are classic cocktails such as the Paloma, Floridora, and Kangaroo, and a mix of unique Alamo drinks with names inspired by 1970s and 80s cult films and performers. These drinks will feature ingredients such as green matcha tea, carrot juice, kombucha, and coconut curry. Draft House bar master Jason McCoon notes having the Tar Heel State's beer is a corporate requirement. National mandate from the Alamo Draft House says that at least 85% of the beers need to be regional or local, he says. They really want us to be Raleigh's Alamo Draft House. Some of the local North Carolina breweries will include Crank Arm, Mother Earth, Burial, Trophy, Pisgah, and Wicked Weed. McCoon will also devote a section of the cinema to become a curated bottle shop. Alamo also will have wines by the glass or bottle, and if you're looking for something with a little more sugar, try the adult milkshakes, such as the goat, a goat cheese, cognac, fig, and honey milkshake. The restaurant is located in the Longview Shopping Center on Newbern Avenue. Former Goodnight's owners open restaurant in Belize. The former owners of Goodnight's Comedy Club, Shannon and Brad Reeder, have started a dramatic new lifestyle. The couple, who owned Goodnight's from 2006 to 2013, recently moved to San Pedro, Belize, and opened a restaurant called Iguana Wands. Shannon Reeder is also a yoga instructor and teaches classes in Belize, and Brad Reeder still does stand up at the restaurant. TBJ recently caught up with the couple and asked them about their new endeavor. Who bought Goodnight's from you in 2013? We sold the club to Helium Comedy Clubs, owned by Mark Grossman. Helium has clubs in Philadelphia, St. Louis, and Buffalo, and Syracuse, and New York. They chose to keep the Raleigh Club operating under the name Goodnight's Comedy Club, as opposed to Helium, because of the long and established history of Goodnight's. What made you ready to retire from the business? We never really decided to retire. The time was just right to sell and to move on to our next adventure. My husband, who started his stand-up comedy career at Goodnight's, has always made his living performing. We opened the restaurant in Belize with the intention of having regular comedy shows, sometimes with Brad headlining and sometimes with comics that we bring down from the U.S. For instance, our first show starred Las Vegas comic Rob Sherwood, the regular opening act for Carrot Top in his MGM Grand Showroom. Who's next for you two with the new restaurant? Or what's next for you two with the new restaurant? Raleigh will always be home. Both of us have family in North Carolina. We still own our home in downtown Raleigh's Oakwood neighborhood and enjoy seeing our friends when we come back. Belize is home for now, but our roots will always be in Raleigh. Minus the wings, Red Bull brings new drinks to North Carolina. North Carolinians will soon have a new organic soda choice with the debut of Organics by Red Bull. The line will feature Simply Cola, Bitter Lemon, Ginger Ale, and Tonic Water. The beverages will be available in the state starting April 2 and only sold in two U.S. markets to start, here in North Carolina and in San Diego, as well as through Amazon.com. Of the new drinks, only Simply Cola has caffeine. The drinks have been certified organic in direct compliance with the USDA National Organic Program. Exotic meats bring people to Durham for a rare bite. Some people love to indulge in extreme sports, but this one's for you if you want extreme food. In April, Durham Bulls City Burger and Brewery is bringing back its popular exotic meats, featuring some rare and hard-to-find meat for its burgers. It has taken us years to find reputable and reliable sources, says the restaurant's social media maven, Megan Sindrick. Some meats are super expensive, as in $30 to $40 per pound for beaver meat, and we have to do sliders to make them affordable. One of its eerie features is the tarantula burger. "We found a source for baked tarantulas," she says. "This burger has the arachnid looking right at you as you take a bite. And these spiders are so difficult to obtain that the restaurant has to raffle off the burgers to guests. Other options include alligator, camel, elk, and cricket pickle chips." In general news, Amazon officials scout Triangle for HQ2 possibilities. Armed with non-disclosure agreements, Amazon scouts were in the Triangle last week, multiple sources confirm. The Seattle e-retailer, which is evaluating sites for its second corporate headquarters that one day could employ as many as 50,000 people, issued stern warnings to the executives and officials it met on its tour, warning them to keep the trip under wraps. And the stakes are high for cooperation, as Raleigh is just one of 20 metros Amazon has identified as potential sites for the Mammoth Project. The stealth it's exhibiting is a complete 180 from phase one of its search, where the company very publicly put cities on notice. It asked interested metros and communities to step up with their pitches. While in the Triangle, Amazon visited several sites and amenities, including Raleigh-Durham International Airport. It met with multiple local officials, including those from universities and colleges in the region. And if scouting trips from other companies are any indication, they likely met with top executives. Public records from other site selection efforts show it's a frequent practice of economic developers on the state to connect companies to area business leaders. Public records show Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst has helped pitch the state to multiple CEOs. The company declined to comment on whether Whitehurst had met with Amazon, but public records shows he's cooperating with the efforts to lure the firm. Doctors accuse Atrium of bloated management in lawsuit. This article is written by Jenna Martin. A group of more than 90 physicians with Atrium Health subsidiary, Mecklenburg Medical Group, is suing the Charlotte-based healthcare system in an effort to separate into an independent practice. The lawsuit filed in Mecklenburg Superior Court alleges Atrium's self-serving, monopolistic, and anti-competitive actions present a threat to those doctors from providing high-quality, cost-effective care to their thousands of patients. It also draws criticism to restrictive employment covenants placed on the doctors by Atrium. "The key reason our physicians want to operate independently is to allow doctors to spend more quality time with patients and provide them with a greater value," said Dr. Dale Owen, a cardiologist with Mecklenburg Medical Group, who is heading its separation efforts. "Operating independently and removing Atrium's overhead costs will be a big plus for our patients." The practice that evolved into Mecklenburg Medical Group was founded in 1936 and grew into the largest multi-specialty medical group in Mecklenburg County, states the suit. It dissolved and became part of Atrium Health, which until recently had been named Carolina's Healthcare System, in 1993. The 92 doctors who filed suit are part of a 104-physician staff that makes up the Mecklenburg Medical Group, which has 10 centers in the Charlotte region and offers specialists in the fields of cardiology, dermatology, endocrinology, and sleep medicine. Mecklenburg Medical Group says it is the largest doctor's practice operated by Atrium. Though purporting to be a nonprofit institution, Atrium, with its bloated management bureaucracy, has repeatedly complained and contended that it loses millions of dollars on the MMG physicians each year, states the 36-page lawsuit filed April 2 in Mecklenburg County Superior Court. Document stated Atrium recently budgeted a loss of $17.6 million in 2018 from the medical practice. An Atrium spokesman said the healthcare provider is reviewing the lawsuit but did not have a comment. Ecolab buys former Coca-Cola site for expansion. On the heels of an $11 million expansion, Ecolab has purchased a former Coca-Cola bottling facility in Greensboro as it prepares to commission its previously announced $27 million expansion. Ecolab, which operates its K Chemical Company division from Greensboro, recently spent $3.1 million to purchase property at 8200 Capitol Drive, previously home to the Coca-Cola bottling operation that relocated to McConnell Center east of Greensboro. The company supplies cleaning and sanitizing products such as degreasers and pot and pan detergents. The 50,000-square-foot warehouse will be used for storage, said Mesa Denny, a spokeswoman for Ecolab, with minimal upfits planned at the facility. The additional storage space will allow us to make more efficient use of our manufacturing and distribution space within our current production area as we continue to grow our business, Denny said. According to public records, K Chemical was also issued a building permit for $1.08 million, 3,524-square-foot commercial alteration at its primary operations at 8300 Capitol Drive. Frank L. Bloom Construction Company was listed as the contractor. K Chemical had 2015 announced it would undertake an $11 million expansion project, including a 37,000-square-foot building for additional office space, 45 new jobs over 3 years, and upgrades to the company's facility at 8300 Capitol Drive. Denny said that expansion was completed in 2016. And as we turn to the TBJ Business Survey Pulse, the question, do you want Amazon to pick the triangle for HQ2? The number of responses were 347. The number of yeses, 57%. Noes, 43%. And you can take the survey at trianglebusinessjournal.com/pulse. And actually, we're going to wind up stopping right there because we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.